President and Commander in Chief, the Constitution enjoins you to be accountable to the people. And so every year you are asked to go to Parliament and give a State of the Nation address. And so you give what the state of the nation is. And it's always done in front of the representatives of the people. But after 3.5 years in office, we believe that it is important for us to go around the country and let the people know what we've done, look at what challenges we have resolved and what still remains to be done, and continue to work to see how we can resolve some of those challenges before the term ends, and to see what others will have to carry forward, you know, after we have won a second term.
Okay, talking about going around to see what we have been able to do, what challenges we have to deal with, etc. You've been in the region since Tuesday. What would you say has been your general impression about government activities going on in the region?
It's been very good. We've had the opportunity to inspect, you know, various ongoing projects. We've had the opportunity to commission several projects that we have completed. And we have interacted with the chiefs and people, and we've spoken about some of their other felt needs that government has to deal with. And so my impressions have been very good. I think in Eastern Region, we've done phenomenal work in all sectors, in provision of water, in provision of electricity, access to electricity, in the field of education, in the area of healthcare, you know, in the area especially of reconstruction of the road network. Eastern Region has one of the most extensive road networks in the country, and for a very long time many of these roads have not been attended to. And so under the Cocoa Roads Program and the Enhanced Road Fund, a strategic roads program, we are tackling a lot of these roads. But the funny thing is, everybody expects that you should be on their road at once, you know. And I was telling the chief of New Ibrim yesterday that development is a process, it's not an event. And so we need to begin somewhere and eventually end somewhere. And so in New Ibrim, we're doing 3 major roads. But of course, there are 5 other roads that he wants me to do. But we need to finish a set of them before we start working on another set of them. So I think progress has been very good, and I'm satisfied and impressed with the work we've done here in the Eastern Region.
Okay. You mentioned what's in road, water, electricity, education, name them, health, etc. But once you have decided to narrow down on road and talk a bit extensively on that, let's also continue with that. Now, you've been to the various sites, I believe. What has been your impression? You said work is progressing. Is that the case?
Yeah. In some cases, work is finished. In others, work is progressing. For instance, a very important road in Eastern Region is the Otekwalu to Odumasi Road. That links Upper Manya with Lower Manya. And that road had been in a very bad state for a long time. In 2012, during the campaign, I came down that road, and it was in a very terrible state. And so we promised that we would work on it. Yesterday, when on the day I went to Odumasi, when I was coming up, the road work is virtually finished. It's just left to the portion where the bridge is going to be replaced. And so there's just about 500 meters to the bridge, which will be done immediately the bridge is installed. That 500 meters will be done, and the road will be handed over. Very beautiful road, and I'm proud that we're able to do that. Aside from that, when I was coming yesterday, we came from Ofwasi to New Ibrim, and you know that there was a portion of the road that was done by Newmont. The remaining portion from Chia to Ofwasi was never done, and so it was in a very bad state. And so we put a contractor on it. It's about 14 kilometers, and he's finished it. So he's joined it with the Newmont stretch. And so now when you're going from Ofwasi to New Ibrim, instead of the period that it used to take you before, it takes you a much shorter time. We're doing the roads in Asamankesi. We're doing the roads in Akwetia area. I mean, there's so many roads in Eastern Region that we are tackling currently that would improve the road network in the region.
Okay, right. You were here, you came to the region, that was somewhere last year, I think around November to cut a sword for work to commence on the Kofodia Bunsu Road, and most of us were very excited at that. You also mentioned in your earlier submission the Abirim Road and other road networks. But months after the sword cutting, we realized work was not progressing. What exactly was the problem? Because we were told the Koko Road money was ready, and we were going to see some massive work commencing immediately, but that was not the case.
I get regular briefings on the progress of work on roads, and the Koko Board has a consultant that regularly monitors to make sure that work is ongoing. And the reason I got for the slowdown in work on the Kofodia Bunsu Road at the time was that because of the very dry Harmattan, there was no water available. You know, when you are doing the base, you need to put water in order to be able to compact the base properly. And during the very dry Harmattan, you remember the Dinsu River and Co all dried up, and so the contractor was having difficulties with locating a good source of water to be able to continue the work, and that's why it slowed down. But my understanding is that work has picked up now, and the work is ongoing.
Okay, but then you would agree with me also that generally there seem to be more or less like stagnation and snail pace progression in terms of road construction and other such infrastructural, constructions. What would you say is the main reason for this? Could it be there are people who say it has to do with funding?
It will mainly be the contractor. When it comes to Koko Roads, absolutely. If the work is not going forward, it's the contractor. Because Koko Board has the money. If you present your certificate on Monday, by Friday you get your check. So definitely it has nothing to do with payment. With Koko Roads, if the work is not progressing, then it has to do with the contractor. But contractors have different capacities. And what we're doing is we're trying to give opportunities to Ghanaian contractors. And some of them work very hard and very, decidedly. Others to work, at a more snail pace, And so it has to do with contractors' capacity. Take the first 50 senior high schools we awarded on contract. I've commissioned 4 of them and their children in the schools. Another 10 are ready. But still, there are some of them in some parts of the country that are on the third floor, and struggling to get to the fourth floor. And so it depends on the contractor, but we need to give opportunities to our people. And so I've insisted that we should give these projects to Ghanaian contractors. But as the projects go on, we will identify those who are good and those who are not good. And once we identify those who are good, we'll give them more work to do. And for those who do not perform, we will gradually weed them out.
Okay. Your Excellency, you were saying 4 of such community senior high schools that you promised are completed. Are you talking about the Eastern region? In the Eastern region?
No, I mean across the country.
Okay.
I've commissioned 4 of them. There are another 12 that are ready for commissioning. And there are others at various stages of completion. They are painting, some are plastering, some are, just finishing hard. And as and when I've told the Ministry of Education, as and when they are completed, they should populate the schools so that children can start learning even while we're commissioning those schools.
Your Excellency, you promised to build about 200 community day senior high schools during your 2012 campaign period. Now, you have so far commissioned some of them. I remember the one at Nyanwa, Kwamba, in the Upper West Achim District of the Eastern Region.
Yep.
How many are currently under construction, especially in the region, and when do you expect to see them admit students?
123 of them are currently under construction. And in the Eastern Region, we have Kwahu Fodwa. We have Mami Krobo, we have Nchemfre, and then Obopa, Sekeswa, Nyamfumang, and Nyanwa. Nyanwa is the one that I commissioned. And so all these are at various stages of completion. The one at Obopa, I hear they are flowing the fourth floor. And then after they flow the fourth floor, they will roof it. And then once they roof it, they will start the finishing work, plastering and putting in the windows and all that. So, like I said, 123 under construction, but they are at different stages of completion. And so as they complete them, we'll populate them with children. As they complete them, we'll populate them with children. For the four that I commissioned, children are already learning in them. If you go to the Atamil Senior High School in Ekunfi, they have 460 students who otherwise would not be in secondary school if that school had not been built. If you go to Bamiyanko, they have about 500 students already enrolled. And so all the schools that we have, you know, commissioned, we've asked the ministry to populate them with children and let learning start.
Okay. Your Excellency, you have barely 7 months to elections. And looking at the time left to the 2012 election or 2016 election, do you think you would be able to build all these 200 community senior high schools within your first term?
We would be able. I think that 123 are ongoing. In 7 months, I don't expect that all the 123 will be completed. But the Ministry of Education is packaging another 50 for award of contracts. And so if we did another 50, then certainly by November, it means that we should have about 173 of those schools awarded on contract. Definitely, I'm not naive to say that we'll finish 200 schools before 2016, but we're giving it our best shot.
Okay. You're listening to GBC Sunrise 106.7, 102.1, all the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation. The segment now is the Development Agenda segment, and my guest in the studio is the President of the Republic of Ghana, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. And you are listening to this program on Unique FM in Accra. You're listening to it on Savannah Radio, Tamale, Twin City Radio, Takari, Garden City, Kumasi, Ubunu, Tema, and Volta Star in the Volta region, whole specifically, and all our affiliates nationwide. My name is Mohamed Zunurain. Now, Your Excellency, still on education. Just yesterday, I think you were at the Kufodia Polytechnic, now Kufodia University of Technology.
Soon to be.
Because I realize they have written a book.
They don't want to be called Polytechnic again. As soon as I launched the initiative, I mean, they prefer to use Technical University. Mm. But the legislation is being finalized, and when Parliament resumes, it will be placed before Parliament. And once Parliament passes it, then I think that some of the polytechnics will be ready by the beginning of the next academic year, which starts in about September, October, to begin running their programs, degree programs.
Okay. Mr. President, some people are of the view that with regard to the conversion of polytechnics into technical universities, even though you commissioned a technical committee to look at the viability and to issue a roadmap on that, you know, other work to be done towards that, some are of the view that their conversion has been rushed. I mean, due diligence hasn't been done for, you know, political expediency, because there's a concern that basic schools and some existing schools are lacking, you know, basic facilities to help teaching and learning. Now, don't you think your government is paying attention to quantity rather than quality?
No, not at all. And this has not been rushed. A lot of diligent work has gone on it. I made this promise to do the conversion of polytechnics to technical universities in 2012. And it's taking how many years? We're in 2016 to be able to achieve, almost 4 years, to be able to achieve this conversion. That cannot be a rush. We have followed a diligent roadmap. We set up a committee of experts to do an appraisal of every single polytechnic. And indeed, that's the reason why we decided that there was not going to be a wholesale promotion of all the 10 polytechnics immediately, and that it was going to be done as and when they met the criteria for promotion. And so a lot of diligent work has been done, and so I don't believe that it has been done in a rush. But let me say that the work we're doing in tertiary education is not exclusive to basic education. It's not that we're concentrating on tertiary education at the expense of basic education. As we are gaining achievements in the tertiary educational level. We're also doing a lot of work at the basic level. Indeed, one of the things I did when I became president was to refocus GetFund to increase their spending at the basic level at the expense of tertiary. And so the bulk of GetFund spending is going to secondary and basic education than to tertiary education. When we came into office, it was the other way around. The majority of spending, more than 60%, was going to tertiary, and less than 40% was going to secondary and basic. We've turned that around. Currently, more than 60% of funding is going to secondary and basic education, and less than 40% is going to tertiary. And so I believe that that's where the emphasis should be, because that is where we have a commitment to meet not only the Millennium Development Goals, the Sustainable Development Goals, to make sure that we achieve universal primary education and make sure that every child of school-going age has the opportunity to go to school. That's why we're expanding secondary education so that children do not end at JHS, so that even if they qualify to go to secondary school, they are not able to go just because they cannot find places in secondary school. And that's why we're building community day schools across the country so that all children can have the opportunity to achieve a secondary education. But that's not all. We're improving teaching and learning in these schools. And so we're providing children with exercise books. Over the, my period in administration, we've distributed more than 100 million exercise books to children. We've distributed textbooks, core textbooks, at the basic level to all the children in public schools. And so before, children used to set three or four of them on one bench and share one textbook. Today, children have their own textbooks that they are able to concentrate on. And so there's a lot that we've been doing. We've been improving the teaching of science and mathematics, you know, by giving training and retraining to basic school teachers who teach science and maths. Recently, Ministry of Finance has given financial clearance to employ 2,500 new science and maths teachers for the basic level. And so the process of recruiting them has begun. And so there's been a very strong emphasis on basic education under my administration, probably even more than on tertiary.
Okay, but Your Excellency, that notwithstanding, we also hear stories of, children having to sit on the floor to learn, and there are still schools under trees, just name them. And I've been to some senior high schools, I mean the dormitories, and sometimes if you look at the level of congestion, when there is an outbreak of disease, it will be very disastrous. How are you addressing all these?
Yeah, Zunurin, I have never claimed anywhere that I've eliminated all the schools under trees. They have existed for years, but we have made a special effort to eliminate them. We have been building. I don't know. Unfortunately, your guests cannot see this brochure, but this is just one district, you know, and it shows the schools that we have taken out at Omani Chrome. You know, it shows you the school before and the school after. The schools that we've taken up at Aswa Bena, you know, the schools that we've taken out at Awaromra, the schools we've taken out at Noyem. I mean, there's so many all over the country. We built more than 1,600 school blocks to take out schools under trees. But there are yet some that exist. And so we'll continue, and we have a strategy for doing it. One of the things we've done to the District Assembly's Common Fund formula is that we've asked every District Assembly to build two school blocks every year. And so if each district assembly is building two school blocks every year, and there are 216 district assemblies, then it means that you're building 432 new school blocks every year. And our estimation is that there are still about 2,500 or so, you know, schools that need to be taken out, basic schools under trees that need to be eradicated. So with the district assemblies building 432 every year, and government and GetFund supplementing by building some more, I believe that by 2020 we should be able to take out the existing schools and the trees. But remember that there will be more springing up, because human settlement spreads. Where there was no community before, people begin to settle, population begins to grow, and there will be the need for a school to be put there. So as you're taking out the existing schools and the trees, there probably would be new schools appearing under trees. And so it's going to be a continuous process that every government will have to continue to do, so that we make sure that children, you know, have a congenial atmosphere for teaching and learning to take place.
Okay. Your Excellency, back to polytechnics or polytechnic universities. Now, we understand these universities are supposed to focus mainly on areas such as engineering, electricals, and the like. Now, here's the case. Most of these polytechnics are already running programs in the arts and business, etc. After the conversion, are these programs going to be phased out, or they are going to continue offering such programs?
They're not going to be phased out, but the percentage of students doing those courses will be minimized, and more engineering, technical, and vocational students would be admitted. And so, for instance, yesterday when I went to the Kofiredua Polytechnic, director announced, he says that currently they have 70% of students doing technical science-related, technology-related courses, and that when they become a technical university, they want to push that up to 90%. And so 90% of those who will be enrolled and doing courses will be doing them in the technical, vocational, and science-related courses, and 10% will be doing their businesses and those other courses. Because we have enough public universities doing business and humanities. We are not converting the polytechnics to become a replica of those other public universities. The polytechnics are being converted to technical universities to provide practical, skilled, trained technical manpower for the world of work. Because we notice that increasingly those are the kinds of people that businesses and industry are looking for. And so we're doing that conversion in order that they can produce more of such manpower for industry and business. And so I expect that with their conversion to technical university status, they would actually increase more the number of people engaged in technology and science and vocational related courses. Already we have technical secondary schools. And so I expect that the technical secondary schools will be their recruiting ground to come straight into the technical universities. And so once children have been doing the technical courses at secondary school, they can just progress seamlessly into the technical universities and continue in electrical engineering, in mechanical engineering, or any of those other, you know, science and technology related courses that they currently are offering.
Very well. Your Excellency, you would agree also with me that unemployment has been one of the major problems confronting our nation. There are thousands of graduates and educated people with the skills who don't have jobs. What are we doing about it? I'm asking this question because over the years, most of the interventions, for example, the National Youth Employment Program and similar interventions have been more or less like managing the situation, but not actually fixing or dealing with it.
Zunurin, part of our unemployment problem, especially at the graduate level, is structural. The economy is growing, you know, the private sector is expanding, and jobs are being naturally created by that process. But it cannot take the 300 and something thousand people coming out, in the majority of them trained in humanities. Industry and business, you know, we did a stakeholder conference and said, what kind of graduates are you looking for? It says we're looking for skilled, practical, hands-on, trained graduates, technicians, and so on and so forth. And so you find that jobs are being thrown up. For instance, there was the case of an oil and gas company looking for 300 welders to do fabrication for oil exploration and drilling. Of the 300 that were interviewed and were went for examination, only 60 passed, and they were looking for 300. And so a company had to take on additional to upgrade their skills in welding, because when they say oil and gas welding, is not our wayside welding that we do. It is up to a certain standard of precision. And so they were giving practical, you know, examination to weld, and then based on how you did it, you were either suitable or not suitable. And so we have some structural problem when it comes to graduate employment, because the majority of the private universities that have come to join the public universities are doing the same courses that the public universities were doing. And so the same business administration, the same humanities, the same arts. And so we're producing 300 and something thousand people graduating from university every year. 80% of them have done humanities, and just 20% or so have done science, technology, engineering, and the other skill courses that we're looking for. So jobs are being produced, but they're not looking for the kinds of graduates that we're producing. And that's why we are encouraging the technical universities to come on board, and then also asking universities that are specialized in some course orientation to keep their focus. For instance, the University of Science and Technology was built as a science and technology university, not as a humanities university. And so we must make sure that the majority of students in University of Science and Technology, overwhelming majority, I know the majority are science and technology related, but the overwhelming majority should be science and technology students. If we talk about the University of Health and Allied Sciences, I don't expect that the University of Health and Allied Sciences should start doing business administration. It is specialized on health and allied sciences. University of Development Studies must focus on integrated development studies and all those kind of things. Now every public university wants to open a law faculty, you understand. But Legon has a law school, and Legon is the premier law school, so let Legon continue training lawyers and let others keep their focus, so that we're creating graduates in different areas that are employable. And then you have private universities come, and all of them are doing exactly the same courses, because it's easy to do humanities. It's easy to set up a tertiary institution and teach humanities. You don't need laboratories, you don't need all those things. And so everybody is taking the easier path. But my hope is that we can tell the National Council on Tertiary Education and say, if another private university wants to come up and they're just going to do humanities, no, we won't accredit you. You must focus on some area that, you know, the economy can employ people, you know, when you have graduated them.
Your Excellency, that is exactly the point. With the conversion of polytechnics into technical universities, why then are we going to allow them to still offer arts and business programs when we know there are universities that are specialized in those areas?
Like I said, they already have some of those faculties set up, and so you cannot close down the faculties. So what we're saying is that the percentage of students in those programs must be significantly lower than the percentage of students in the other areas that we want them to focus on. And that's why I said, like Koforidua, they said they were aiming for 90% and 10%, which is a good thing. And I think that all the other polytechnics should take a cue from that. But talking about employment, I'll just give you a few examples of jobs created. If you take the Kumasi Shoe Factory, we created 200 jobs by setting up the Kumasi Shoe Factory. The Savannah Cement Factory at Bwipe has created 3,000 jobs in Bwipe. The Ghana National Gas Company has created 265 new jobs. The Youth in Agriculture Program has created 23,000 jobs. If you take the Graduate Business Support Scheme run by the Ministry, it's created 2,000 jobs. The National Vocational Training Institute and Community Center for Employable Skills has created 21,802 jobs. The Rural Enterprise Project has created 21,000 jobs. NBSSI, 2,000 jobs. Gratis, 500 jobs. And I could just run through Commander Sugar Factory when it becomes operational, including those who work in the factory and the outgrower farmers, is going to create 7,300 jobs. New Fish Processing Plant at El Nina, 2,500 jobs. The Business Processing Outsourcing Center near Kwame Nkrumah Interchange, which I'll be commissioning soon, is going to create 10,000 jobs. The Takoradi Harbor Expansion is creating 3,000 new jobs. The Tema Harbor Expansion is going to create 4,000 new jobs. Aside from all this, we have the Youth Employment Agency, which is going to create 100,000 jobs. You know, so jobs are being created. In addition, if you take even the public works we're doing, the road construction, you know, all over the country, the cocoa roads, just imagine the number of jobs.
Your Excellency, sorry to cut in.
Yeah.
We're talking about sustainable jobs.
Yes.
For instance, if people are employed in a road construction project and the project ends, what happens to them?
Road construction is ongoing. It doesn't stop. As a contractor is finishing a job, like I told you, the new Ibrim chief was talking about five roads. We're doing three roads, and he's talking of five other roads. And so
you also mentioned the harbor project.
Yeah, the harbor project.
When that one also ends.
When construction is taking place, it creates jobs. When the project is completed, it creates jobs because you need people to work in the expanded port. Currently, with the Temaport expansion, it's going to be able to take five times the volume of what the current port is taking. So you're going to need more stevedores, you're going to need more shore handlers, you're going to need, you know, all kinds of specialized skills, forklift operators and all that. So what I'm saying is, while you're working on the project, it is creating jobs. And when you finish the project, it creates permanent, sustainable jobs. But even with public works, even the most advanced countries, if you go to the U.S., they are still doing public works. Even though you'd say that their infrastructure should be at a certain level, and yet every day they are building bridges, they are building roads, they are building all kinds of, you know, projects. So far, we estimate that if you take public works and the construction sector and the work we're doing in roads and schools and hospitals and things, we believe that over the last 3 years, we've created 400,000 new jobs. And so job creation is taking place, but like I said, we need to find out what skills are they looking for. There's an example of a company that had to bring an operator from outside to operate a crane. You see these tall overhead cranes? They couldn't get an operator immediately, and they couldn't get a skilled operator immediately. So they had to fly an operator from outside to come and operate the crane until they were able to identify a skilled Ghanaian operator to take it over. And so the jobs are coming up, but we need to make sure that our young people are being guided into the areas where they can find those jobs.
Very well. You're listening to GBC Sunrise 106.7, 102.1 FM, the pride of the East. And my guest this morning on the development agenda is His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama, President of the Republic of Ghana. You're listening to this program live on Ubunu FM in Tema, Unique FM in Accra, Volta Star in Ho, Radio Savannah, Tamale, Ira Radio, Upper West, Upper East Radio, Upper West, Twin City Radio, Takari, Garden City Radio in Kumasi, and all our affiliates nationwide. Now, Your Excellency, investment is one area that many believe could help address some of the economic problems of the country. But unfortunately, interest rates are very high, not to talk about soaring utility tariffs. These are obvious disincentives to investment and, by extension, job creation. How is your government tackling these problems?
We're tackling them head on. As you know, over the last few years, we had some challenges with the economy, and I took a decision to go into an IMF program. And since we went into the program, we've been undertaking structural reforms that have stabilized the economy, and we are returning to a period of growth. If you look at the World Bank report that appeared yesterday, it named Ghana as one of the countries, you know, with very high expectations of growth, and it said that the prospects for the Ghanaian economy are high, and that investor confidence, you know, has risen, and that Ghana is entering a new era, you know, where prosperity can blossom. And so I don't know if you saw that report, but if you read it, it shows that Ghana has very good prospects going forward. Now, what is happening is, I've always said that a family's budget is similar to the budget of a country. And you need to make sure that you're balancing your expenditures and your incomes. And so in 2012, when I became president, we found that the deficit to GDP had risen significantly to almost 12% of GDP. As I speak, we currently have reduced the deficit to GDP to below 7.3. The target for last year was 7.3, and I think we did about 7.2. This year we're going to bring that to 5.3, and if we bring it to 5.3, then it means that inflation is going to gradually come down. We're looking to bring inflation back down to single digits, and then once inflation is coming down, then interest rates would also gradually follow. And so the prospects look very good, and I am very bullish about the Ghanaian economy. If you take the Economic Intelligence Unit, you know, they said that 2017 and onward is going to be a period of prosperity for Ghana. And that is because of the foundation that we have laid. It's because of the work that we have done. We've eliminated a lot of the deficits that were created by huge subsidies on utility tariffs. We've eliminated a lot of the deficit that created huge the subsidies that created huge deficits on the cost of petroleum products. Today, as I speak, TOR is running, the Temori refinery is running and producing petroleum products for Ghana. We have enough stocks of LPG gas. Our tanks and our reserves, strategic reserves for petroleum products, are all full. And so we have ships standing offshore Ghana with petroleum products, but there's no space to offload those products. And so we've done a good job in stabilizing various sectors of the economy. Today we're supplying diesel and petrol to Burkina Faso and Mali from our Bauga depot. Our Bauga depot was shut down for so many years. The pipeline from Bupe to Bauga was not operational. Today we're pumping fuel from Bupe to Bauga, and we're loading 40 trucks a day to Burkina Faso and Mali. I mean, if that is not economic progress, I don't know what else anybody will call economic progress. Yes, we've been through a period of challenges, and we've had to make sacrifices as citizens. But I believe that in everyone's life, there are times when you have to make sacrifices in order that things get better for the future. We're working to ensure that we create a better future for not only our citizens of today, but for our citizens of tomorrow. And I believe we're doing a good job at it. The economy is more resilient today than it was in the past. It's not an economy in crisis, absolutely not. If you see an economy in crisis, you know that it is an economy in crisis. This economy is not in crisis, and it is growing. The World Bank, the African average growth rate predicted by the World Bank and IMF is 3%, and for Ghana they predict 3.3%. I'm more bullish. I believe that Ghana will grow closer to 4%, maybe between 3.8% and 4%, and we predict that in 2017 Ghana's economy is going to grow by about 6%. And so this country is doing well. We have resolved the power crisis. We've been able to match demand and supply. And so the electricity crisis that hit us, you know, is gradually becoming a thing of the past. Today the FPSO is shut down, but we make contingency arrangements, and we're firing most of the power plants using crude oil, you know, and we're providing enough electricity for our people, because we've done the structural changes that ensure that the utilities can continue to provide us with power. We have signed the agreement with ENI, which is a $7.5 billion investment agreement, the single largest investment ever made in Ghana, probably after the Akosombo Dam, and that is going to provide sufficient 1.5, you know, how many million cubic feet of gas to produce power. The regional electricity market for West Africa is going to become operational at the end of this year, at the end of 2016. It means that if Ghana is able to produce more power and we have excess, we can put it on the regional electricity market and supply it to Burkina Faso and to Mali and to others who do not have enough power. And so we are on the right track. Investor confidence is high. The last Association of Ghana Industries Investor Confidence Index shows that there's high confidence in the prospects of the Ghanaian economy. And so we're doing something right. And if anybody says that this economy is in crisis, then it's mainly for political propaganda purposes.
Right. Your Excellency, you touched on energy. I mentioned that your government has been able to stabilize the erratic power situation experienced in the past few years. Would you therefore say that Dumso has ended?
I'd say yes, we are out of the woods, and that we're able to match demand and supply. But let me say that we need to build our redundancy. The fact that you match demand and supply does not mean that you have completely resolved the issue. You need to build what they call redundancy. So if demand is, say, 2,000 megawatts, you must have about 2,200 megawatts, so that if you have a problem with any of your existing plants, you have an excess capacity that will fill in the deficit. And so I used my words carefully. I said we've matched demand and supply, but we are continuing to build redundancy, and that's why we're putting in more plants, so that we'll have an excess. And so if we have an excess of, let's say, 300 megawatts or 400 megawatts, then it means that if we have a problem with any of our existing plants, we still have enough power to be able to contain the situation. And so that's what we're working on. But currently, we're able to supply enough electricity across the country to whoever wants it. But we must continue to build on our redundancy. And we're working on the things that will make our power supply sustainable. So, for example, in the eastern part, in Tema, we normally have about 600 megawatts of thermal generation that is stranded because we don't get enough gas from the West African gas pipeline. And so even though we have the power plants there, we're not able to run them because we don't have gas. And those plants run only on gas. And so if the gas doesn't come, you cannot use light crude oil. That is like KTPP, the Kontema plant. Asogli runs on only gas. We've just finished Asogli Phase 2, the first part, which is 180 megawatts. I'm going to commission it sometime next month. It runs on only gas. And so anytime gas does not come through the West African gas pipeline, then it means that almost 500 to 600 megawatts of power is not available to us. And so what we're doing is, we have signed an agreement to bring what we call a floating storage regasification unit, an FSRU. It is a floating barge where you can bring LNG. The gas is liquefied. You bring it liquefied. You pass it through the regasification unit. It turns it back to gas and then feeds it to the thermal plant. It's just as good as piping gas through the pipeline. And so we have signed the agreement, and our hope is that by the end of the year, we should have this floating storage regasification unit in place. And then what would happen is, if we don't get gas from the West African gas pipeline, then we can use liquid natural gas to ensure that our thermal plants in the Tema area are running. But when ENI comes, ENI is going to bring additional gas, almost 150 million cubic feet a day. The Etiabu gas plant is doing about 100 million cubic feet a day. And so ENI is going to be 150 million cubic feet. So it means that that's 250 million cubic feet a day. It means we can run more thermal plants. And then when Greater Jubilee comes on stream, that is another 150 million cubic feet of gas. Then we have the 10th field for which the FPSO has arrived, the FPSO John Evans Atta Mills. That is going to give us another 80 million standard cubic feet of gas. So the prospects for electricity production in Ghana are very bright, and we've taken all the steps to make sure that Ghana becomes the major power hub of West Africa by the year 2020. By the year 2020, Ghana will be supplying not only itself with gas, more than with electricity more than we need, but we will be the major supplier of electric power to our neighboring countries.
Your Excellency, Ghanaians are complaining about high electricity tariffs. They're saying it's almost unbearable. Electricity, water, and so on. And some people have described your government as insensitive to the plight of the ordinary Ghanaian. What can you say to that?
Normally, what you must do is you must look at the alternative. The alternative is the darkness we came from. The reality of the fact is that Ghana had cheap power. We had cheap power because of hydro. Hydro is about 4 cents to 5 cents per kilowatt hour. And so for many years, when Akosombo was established, the whole of Ghana, at the time Akosombo started, the whole of Ghana was consuming probably just about 100 megawatts. And Valco was taking, that's why Valco was established, to make use of the Akosombo power. Valco was taking 270 megawatts. And so our total consumption was about 370 megawatts, certainly less than 400 megawatts. Now, Akosombo is a 1,020 megawatt plant. And so for many years, it was able to supply Ghana with as much power as we needed. And then we built the pump plant. The pump plant is about 170 megawatts. So if you add that to 1,020 megawatts, then you're talking of almost 1,200 megawatts. And so while our consumption was less than Akosombo could supply, power was cheap. Now when you bring in thermal generation goes for between 12 to 16 cents per kilowatt hour. Compare that to 4 to 5 cents. It's more than nearly double the price of hydro. Unfortunately, because of climate change, Akosombo today, as I speak, is producing about 400 megawatts because the water level is low. Pong, one turbine is shut down, so Pong is producing with only two turbines, and so Pong is producing less than 100 megawatts. We has a capacity of 400 megawatts, but they bring it in only at peak periods from 6 to 11 in the night. Because of the nature of that particular dam, it cannot run all day long. You deplete the water. So it comes in only at 6 to 11. The rest of the power we consume is thermal power. And so we've shifted from the era of cheap hydropower to the era of more expensive thermal power. Now, if you maintain tariffs based on the fact that the bulk of your power was coming from hydro, then what you're doing is you're killing your utilities because they cannot pay the cost of the crude oil and the gas that they need to continue to provide you with power. And so what has happened is a reflection of the tariffs are beginning to reflect the transition from cheap hydro to thermal. Now, if we say that we will continue to pay the cheaper hydro cost, then a time will come when VRA cannot meet its expenses, it cannot pay its suppliers, and so it will shut down the thermal plants. And that's why I said, the question we must always ask ourselves is, what is the alternative? The alternative is darkness. And after what we've gone through over the last couple of years, I think that Ghanaians don't want to go back into darkness. But I do sympathize, and I think we must do something, you know, to be able to ameliorate the pressure, especially on Ghanaians who have low incomes. And that's exactly what we're doing. I announced in the State of the Nation address that we're going to roll out a solar program so that small and medium enterprises and small households whose consumption is low, you know, are appropriate to be transitioned onto solar. And so, as I speak, we have 4,000 rooftop solar panels that we have begun to install in small barbering shops, in hairdressing saloons, so that, you know, the people who run these shops would get some relief from their high electricity bills. We can do it also for households. And so we're looking at poor households that cannot afford electricity bills so that we can put the solar panels on their rooftops. It will be able to provide them the services of electric funds. It will give them the services of, you know, putting on their lights. They can have a plug where they can plug their television. They can have a small fridge that provides them with water. And so those that have a low power factor, we can transition onto solar. What we're doing too is we're coming up with what we call off-grid solar solutions. So for communities that are not near the transmission grid, instead of the cost of pulling the transmission grid that long, we rather will give them, you know, solar solutions. It's been done in other places. We can do it. You go and buy your units, you punch in your prepaid unit, and the solar power feeds in. As I speak, like I said, in the State of the Nation, some of the facilities, small and medium enterprises we provided with solar, Young Dollar Barbering Shop at Mamobi, and one of these days I'm going to go there and have a haircut. We have Alice Skills Training Center for Hairdressers. That's at the trade fair. We have Dara Beauty Parlor. It's at South Labadi. We have Renee Designs at Dima. We have Emakansi Tailoring at Alajo. We have Mercy Fashions at Lashibi. There's many of these small and medium enterprises we've given solar. And as a result of that, it has reduced their power consumption. And so that's something that government is looking to roll out. I've set a target of 200,000 rooftop solar components, which we'll give to small and medium enterprises and to small households.
Okay, but Your Excellency, how do you intend to cushion the ordinary Ghanaian worker who will not benefit from all these solar lantern distribution from, you know, this high tariffs?
They are not solar lanterns. That's a correction. They're not solar lanterns. We put the panel on the roof, and then we pass it through the wiring. And so you have a plug, you have your lights, your ceiling fans and everything, you know, working, you know, properly. And so it's more than just solar lanterns. We also have in the tariff what we call a lifeline. And so for those who consume below 50 kilowatts, you know, of power, the first 50 band, they get a very much lower subsidized rate. And so if your power factor is lower, then it means that you are able to enjoy the subsidy. The subsidy affects actually the two bands. But when you go into higher power consumption, then you pay more. And so we try to encourage everybody to conserve power. For instance, when you are leaving the house, there's no need for you to leave the lights and the television and all that on. You understand? You can switch them off so that it conserves power. Don't use a boiler to heat water to bath, because that boiler, when you put it on, consumes a lot of electricity. Don't use an electric cooker. Rather use gas, because if you use an electric cooker, it draws a lot of power. We're saying that when you're going to iron your things at once, you know, the things you wear at once, so that if he doesn't come and switch the iron on, it heats up, he irons his shirt, he switches it off, it goes cold again. Amma comes and switches it on again, it heats up, she irons her skirt, she goes away again. Mommy comes and switches it on. If you bring all those things together, you spend about 1 hour, you iron all, you hang them on curtains, on rails, then it saves you the cost of switching your iron off and on, off and on. And anytime you switch it off and on, it consumes more power. So there are many tips that the Energy Commission keeps giving so that we can all lower our power factor.
You're listening to Sunrise on 6.7 FM.
I go around my house every day switching off lights, and I'm training the kids to switch off lights and switch off the television, you know, when after they finish watching it. I make sure that no air conditioning is left on when there's nobody in the room. I do that just to make sure that, you know, we are conserving power. I've made them put solar panels on my roof, and so some of the lights in the house are being controlled by solar power, and they are not taking power from the national grid. Yes.
Very well. We have just about 17 minutes more to 10 a.m. You're listening to GBC Sunrise 106.7, 102.1 of the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation. The program is a development agenda, and my guest is the President of the Republic of Ghana, His Excellency John Dramani Mahama. My name is Mohamed Zimmerwain, and this program is live on Unique FM in Accra and all our affiliates nationwide. Your Excellency, let's now turn our attention to security. One of the major security concerns in parts of the Eastern and Ashanti regions is the Fulani Herdsmen menace, specifically in the Agogo and Afan Plains area. The people of Agogo, for instance, staged a demonstration to press home their demand for the herdsmen to be flushed out, as they blame the security forces for developing cold feet in dealing with this issue. How does your government intend to find a lasting solution to this recurrent Fulani Herdsmen menace?
We must encourage the movement from free-range cattle rearing to intensive cattle rearing. If you go to countries where they produce more beef than us, they don't have cows roaming all over the country. The cows are secluded, and they grow them intensively. We import beef from countries in Europe. In those countries, the cows are not walking around and eating people's crops and all that kind of thing. And so it's a transition that we need to make. A lot of these herdsmen, you know, have been brought there by some of the traditional rulers and some of the public officials. And my understanding is that they give them cows from time to time. And so they have a penchant of, you know, protecting these people. And the point is, we are mainly an agricultural country. We're not a country of herds people who rear livestock. In the northern part of the country, yes, there are people who have cattle, but they have never had them in the numbers that we have seen now. What is happening is, because of climate change, the Sahel is getting drier, and so this area where a lot of these herdsmen were, you know, they are not able to get enough pasture for the animals, and so they have started shifting southwards. Before, they used to come southwards, and then when the rainy season starts, they go back to the Sahel. Now a lot of them are not going back. They, because of climate change and the dry nature of the Sahel, the previous pastures they have dried up, and so they've moved down into the West African forest belt and are permanently grazing their cattle. It's a problem that affects not only Ghana, it affects Cote d'Ivoire, it affects Sierra Leone, it affects Liberia, you know, it affects Guinea, because they have moved from the Sahel into the West African belt. And because of the new protocols that we have in respect of free movement of our people, these are ECOWAS citizens, you know, and so in terms of immigration and all that, they really haven't flouted, you know, the rules. In any case, most of them, and I'm saying that we shouldn't profile, because we normally use the name of a particular ethnic group. And like the secretary, General Secretary of NDC was saying yesterday, it's not about the ethnic group, it's about the herdsmen and the confrontation they are creating with our farmers. Because we need the maize, we need the beans, we need those crops to feed. And so if the animals are destroying them, it must be a concern. And government has deployed security forces to push them back, but after a while they drift back, you know, into the area where there's conflict between them and the farmers. And so government will do that again. I made the CDS, the Army Commander, and the Inspector General of Police go to Agogo and look at the situation there, and I've told them to come up with an operational plan to resolve the issue. The other time what we did was we pushed them to the areas that were not very inhabited, and so it reduced the conflict. Unfortunately, they have drifted again towards, you know, where there are a lot of settlements and where farmers are farming. And so they'll come up with an operational plan to do just that. And it shouldn't just be Agogo. It's in many parts of the country, even in my own district. In Bole, we have, you know, agitation between farmers and these Fulani herdsmen. So we need a comprehensive solution to it across the country, not only in respect of Agogo.
Very well. Your Excellency, another issue which has become of great concern is the issue terrorist attack in the wake of attacks on our western and northern neighbors, Cote d'Ivoire and Burkina Faso recently. Do we have what it takes to prevent such occurrences in Ghana? What can you tell Ghanaians as the commander-in-chief of the Ghana Armed Forces to allay our fears?
I think that we must deal with this without creating panic, you know, amongst our people. And that's why stories we see in the papers today are most unfortunate. There was a signal, a message from National Security asking the regional security councils and others to be on the alert in the event of a possible threat. Earlier we had held the national security meeting and we had issued a statement and said that because of what had happened, all West African countries were at risk, and we believe that all West African countries, you know, are at risk. And so we need, indeed no country is safe anywhere in the world, and so we need to be alert and be prepared for any such eventuality. Unfortunately, in the signal that went to the regional security councils, whoever wrote it indicated the intelligence that national security was dealing with, and I didn't think that that was necessary. You didn't need to put the intel in there, you just needed to send a directive asking for alertness and asking them to search more thoroughly vehicles and all that. But be that as it may, you know, every country in West Africa is at risk. I mean, even countries in Europe, look at what's happening in Belgium, in France, and all these places. And we are at risk not only from external forces, but even from internal forces. We have evidence of radicalization of our own citizens, you know, who have gone out to go and join some of these terrorist groups. And it's not only Ghana, there are other countries where, as a result of the use of internet and propaganda, you know, we have, you know, some young fertile minds in which the seed of terrorism has been planted. And so we need to be on the alert, not only in respect of Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, but also in respect of any of our own citizens who are radicalized, who go and slip back in and do anything. Now, we are in contact with allies who we share intelligence with. And Cote d'Ivoire is an ally. Actually, all our West African countries, our intelligence chiefs have agreed that we will share information on terrorist movements and things to do with terrorism. And so we get intelligence from Cote d'Ivoire, we get intelligence from Burkina Faso. Aside from that, we have other countries like the United States, France, United Kingdom and others. Recently, the Ethiopian Prime Minister was here. And you know, Ethiopia has been dealing with Al-Shabaab for a long time. And he offered us training of trainers, you know, for our special forces to be able to respond in the event of any such attack. And so we're going to send our military there to arrange for some of our people to go and train and come back and train our people. But we have trained our own special forces, and currently we have a number of them, significant number, that are well trained and on standby in the event that anything like this happens. What happens is, if something like this happens, is how quickly you are able to deploy and, you know, deal with it. And so if you notice in Cote d'Ivoire, it is estimated that within 45 minutes to at least before an hour of when the incident happened, the special forces were on the ground and were able to take out four of the terrorists. Unfortunately, three of the special forces in Cote d'Ivoire died, and other foreign nationals had been killed before they arrived. And so we are preparing for any such eventuality, but we need the alertness of the public. The public needs to be more alert today than we've ever been before. If you see any strange person, you see any strange movement, you know, you just need to inform the security services so that we can investigate and find out if it's a threat or not. We've asked all the hotels to be more vigilant, and so you find that if you go to many of the big hotels in Ghana today, they'll ask you to open your boot, they'll search your car. We have to undergo that inconvenience in order to keep our people safe. But our security agencies are working on any contingency so that if anything like that happens, we'll be able to respond. Terrorists are looking for soft targets. They'll go to the beach where people are just enjoying themselves, have no weapons, and just start shooting people. Or they'll go into a hotel and take hostages. Or they'll go to a place where there's a mass event, you know. And these are all soft targets. And so it's very difficult to decide where they would appear, but you need to be sure that where you think that something like that can happen, you either improve security or you have forces at a distance where they can be on the spot in the shortest possible time to be able to rescue people.
Okay. Mr. President, still on security, before we move on to corruption, we're going to be going to the polls on November 7th, and during such periods, people live in fear that something untoward could happen because of the experience of other countries within the sub-region and the pocket of violence recorded in our own country during past elections. Even though this has not escalated into civil unrest, given the stakes in this year's election, what measures are you putting in place to ensure peace before, during and after the elections?
I believe that since we established the 1992 constitution, Ghana has consolidated her constitutional democracy, and we have had enough experience in running elections, you know, peacefully and successfully, and I don't see why the seventh election must be any different from the preceding elections. Ghanaians are peace-loving people, and I don't think that they're going to allow anybody to endanger the safety and security of this nation. If anybody wants to resort to violence, I think that our security agencies have the capacity to quickly deal with them. I want to say that I am committed to peace, and I don't believe that any violence will occur in this country as a result of my standing as president. And I think that all political leaders must make the same commitment. We have constitutional means, you know, to deal with anything untoward that happens during the elections. And I believe that the leading opposition party has taken advantage of that before, after the 2012 elections. And so we must use legitimate means to express our grievances, and nobody must undertake violence to prove any point or to justify any grievance that they have suffered in elections. And so I believe that we are able to deal with it. Our police service, we've increased the numbers, and so we're going to be able to have, you know, security services everywhere. We intend to have a security personnel at every single of the 26,000 polling stations across the country to be able to deal with anything that happens. We're going to have police and military contingents at specific areas so that if anything happens, they can be there in the shortest possible time and deal with the situation. So the contingency arrangements are being made to ensure security during the elections, but I don't believe that anything, you know, untoward that will endanger the peace and safety of Ghana would happen as a result of the 2016 election.
You're listening to Sunrise on 106.7 FM.
And we also live on 102.1 FM and all our affiliates nationwide. Now, Your Excellency, let's move on to corruption. You are being perceived as being too soft on your appointees who engage in acts of, you know, corruption. In other words, some people are of the view that you rather shield them and even reward them with new positions. What can you say to that?
That's absolutely not true. Absolutely not true. And in dealing with corruption, let's separate facts from political propaganda. In Ghana, we have a strong contest for political power, and so it's in the interest of, you know, the contestants to try to use corruption as a political instrument for gaining political power. And so we should separate what is political propaganda, you know, from the actual, you know, instruments for the fight against corruption. Indeed, if you talk about the fight against corruption, I would say that this government has done more in the fight against corruption than the previous government. There is a time in this country where a president said, "I will not investigate corruption and bring down my administration." This is a quote that all Ghanaians have heard. And since 1992, aside from Rawlings, who put some of his appointees before the Committee on Human Rights and Administrative Justice, all corruption cases investigated have been after the regime. It's always waited till after the regime, then the new government comes in and pursues those who were in government before. This is the first government that is prosecuting corruption as and when we find it. I set up the sole commissioner for judgment debts to investigate allegations of corruption in settlement of judgment debts. And the report has come. We published the white paper. I've given stringent instructions to the Attorney General to defend every case of judgment debt. Because of that, she saved us almost $1 billion in the last 4 years. And the facts are all here in this book. Every single case that she's defended and how much the claim was against government. And so the fight against corruption has been taken to a whole new level by this government. We set up a report on a commission on JIDA. It came out with its recommendations. Those who are being prosecuted are being prosecuted. It recommended retrieval of money, which was giving us loans to some companies. And IOCO has been pursuing those companies and has retrieved more than 50 million Ghana cedis. And so that is ongoing. If you take the case of the National Service, where ghost names were inserted, we have dismissed 163 people. 34 people are before the courts as I speak today. And all that we have undertaken. And I have made a commitment. I said, where corruption is exposed under my administration, we shall take steps to deal with it. But it's not only the executive that deals with corruption. You have to put the people before the courts. And I am not supposed to run the courts. And so if I find somebody and I take him to court, the court says give him bail while the trial goes on. So you see him in town driving his Mercedes. It's not because I want him out, you know, driving his Mercedes. I want him in there, but we have to go through the due process. And that's why I say we cannot be adherents of constitutionalism and at the same time be admirers of arbitrary justice. In the past, if it was an unconstitutional regime or military regime, we'll catch them and lock them up, and then we'll put them before trial. If the trial says they are free, we'll leave them. But we must follow the constitution. We must follow, you know, due process. And the point is, we cannot be hypocritical about corruption. The standard measure for corruption is the Transparency International Index. In the last Transparency International report, Ghana and Senegal were singled out as two countries that were doing a lot to stem corruption.
Well, Your Excellency, many times when such reports come and they are in our favor, we are quick to use it to, explain issues to our advantage. But when they go against us, we deny them question the basis of their findings.
Transparency International is a recognized organization, and indeed, if you take the world, its index is the most respected index on corruption in the world. And so if Transparency indicts you, you must look at the points on which they've indicted you and see how you can improve. And I have never spoken and said we don't accept a Transparency International report, but it's the other people. When the Transparency International report indicts Ghana, then they beat a whole drum with it and say, you see, Transparency says Ghana is corrupt. But when Transparency says, Ghana and Senegal are doing well in the fight against corruption, then, forget Transparency International. You can't eat your cake and have it. We must have a single standard. And Transparency International report says Ghana is the seventh least corrupt country in Africa, according to the last report. And so we need to strip corruption of the political propaganda that we've clothed it in, and it's a concern for all of us. All of us must fight it together. And for me, what I think is that it's not even good enough to wait for corruption to occur before you investigate and sanction. You must put in place the processes that make it impossible for people to be corrupt.
Very well.
And that's why we're applying information and communication technology. That's why we are deploying the gift myth to reduce human discretion in budget spending. That's why we are improving, most of our processes and taking away as much human discretion as possible so that we reduce the temptation for people to be corrupt. That's why we're opening Citizens Complaints Bureau. We've opened the first one where people can go and report, cases of corruption or abuse of office. And once the first one we've opened is successful, we're going to open it in all the regions and eventually in all the districts.
This one is going to be about wrapping up, but I have two more questions before you go. Now, why is it that many a times well-intentioned politicians, after winning elections, all of a sudden turn around to start doing the very wrong things that they sought to correct when they are given a mandate? And I believe you tie this on with what makes you so confident of winning the November polls in spite of the complaints of hardship in the country.
This is a double barrel question. I don't know from where to start to deal with it, but I'd say that this country has faced challenges, in many times. I cannot remember, a period where we would say that all our economic problems had been solved and we were living in an era of prosperity. And what we're doing is continuing to work on what was built upon by my predecessors. President Rawlings began structural reforms under the PNDC, and then as civilian president from 1993 to he handed over in 2000, he has continued to work to improve the economy of the country. President Kufuor took it over from him. We went into HIPC, we came out of HIPC, and he continued to work to build the economy. And President Mills took it over and took us, to the point that we got to. And I came and I've continued from where my predecessors left off. And so we continue to work to improve the lives of our people. And if you look at the indicators, you would see that there is a sense, as a result of the successive work that has been done by different governments, you see that Ghana has made progress. We have come to become the second largest economy in West Africa after Nigeria. Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa because of their oil resources and, you know, the bountiful natural resources they have. But if you take West Africa, Ghana is the second largest economy. And so when I hear people touting our neighbor Cote d'Ivoire is the third largest economy after Ghana. We have a bigger economy. And if you take the Human Development Index, the UN Human Development Index, Ghana comes first in West Africa before Nigeria and Cote d'Ivoire. Access to water, access to electricity, access to motorable roads, access to education. We are number one in West Africa in the UN Human Development Index. And so when we denigrate our own economic progress and say that there's hardship or things are not going well, you know, then we don't recognize the progress that we're making. Even take the advanced countries, say the United States. I'm sure that you go there and people will say times are hard, you know. Or if you went to UK, people will say times are hard. Recently, my friend who's lived in the UK for 21 years, he just packed his bags and came home. He says because he can't survive anymore. Times are hard. And so across the world, China is slowing down. There's economic crisis in the West. Now oil producers are suffering. Nigeria's economy is troubled. Saudi Arabia is borrowing money for the first time and drawing on their reserves. So there's a complete world economic crisis going on. But if you look at our economy is a bit more resilient than it was in the past. In the past, these global shocks would immediately have translated into our economy. But you can see that we're still growing. You know, this year I expect that we'll grow at almost 4%. And we're still, our economy is not going into a tailspin like other people are suffering. So we're making some progress. And if we recognize that progress is happening, then it will encourage our people to work even more to ensure that we're able to get them into this era of prosperity. And like I was telling you, the World Bank and others are very bullish about the Ghanaian economy. And I was trying to read it to you, but I hadn't found it. It says there are high expectations for the Ghanaian economy to pick up this year. A new World Bank Group report has revealed, and it says that the prediction is on the back of increased investor confidence in the Ghanaian economy, oil production from new oil fields, and solution to the country's energy crisis. And so, this is the World Bank. It's not me saying it. And so, yes, I would say that a lot of our people are still vulnerable because of the structural reforms we're undertaking. But that's why we're introducing a lot of social protection measures. We've expanded the Livelihood Against Poverty program, that's the LEAP program, from about 60,000 families to more than 150,000 families today. We have increased the number of children on school feeding from 400,000 to more than 1.5 million children today. We've, like I said, distributed 100 million textbooks. We've distributed last year 10,000 school sandals. We're doing a lot of things to try and cushion the very poor and vulnerable. All the skills development programs we're doing is all supposed to economically empower, you know, our people across the country. And so, yes, I wouldn't say that we're out of the woods. I know some people or a good number of our people, you know, are vulnerable, and government will continue to work to improve their lives. That's why we're building hospitals in order that they can have access to health care. That's why we're building, you know, new secondary schools so that our children can have access. That's why we've introduced free, you know, education at the secondary level for day students. We're going to expand it to cover boarding students progressively. And so that's why government is taking all these measures. And I believe that as Ghanaians, if we believe in ourselves and we believe in our country, we would be able to make it like other countries have done. And I pledge to continue to provide, you know, a leadership of integrity, a leadership of truth and transparency, so that people, you know, would know that the leadership empathizes, you know, with what they're going through.
Mm. Very well, Your Excellency. I believe we draw the curtains here and then end proceedings, because His Excellency, is a very busy person, and he has other engagements, for which reason he has to leave us. Even though we have other areas we weren't able to explore, I believe we will reserve it for another time. Your Excellency, your final words.
Well, I want to thank the people of the Eastern Region for the very warm welcome they have given me since I arrived in the region 3 days ago. We've had a wonderful tour, and I'm looking forward to today's program. We're going to Abetifi to inspect progress of work on the new Abetifi hospital, and then from there we'll also inspect the Kwawu water project at Kotoso that is supposed to provide, you know, the whole of the Kwawu ridge with clean drinking water. And then from there I'm going to the Afram Plains. We have provided a brand new ferry for the crossing from Afram Plains to Kwando Toko, and so we're going to commission that ferry, and I'm going to take a ride on the ferry from Agodeke to Kwando Toko, and that would be the final event for the first phase of my Eastern Regional tour. We haven't covered the whole region. This is just a first phase. We will come and cover the other parts of the region that we have not gone yet.
Okay. Thank you very much, Your Excellency. And
I'm also visiting the Zongo. Kofedwa Zongo is reputed to be the best
Zongo
in the country, and is the result of Colonel Minyala in the Achampon time, who relayed the whole place and made it look nice. I'm going to visit them in the Zongo, and so the Zongo Imam and the Zongo chiefs, I'll be with you soon.
Thank you very much, Excellency. We appreciate your time with us. We are very humbled by your presence. Right, so that was His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama. He's been my guest on the Development Agenda program this morning. My name is Mohammed Zinuroin. The program was produced by Frank Ode Emim Bismarck, Iwache Isabella, and with assistance from our technical and also our engineering team. Thank you very much once again, Your Excellency.
Thank you, Zinuroin.
Right, and so this is where we draw the curtains on this morning's edition of Adeha Chimbia, your number one morning drive. With me,